I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. When the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act was signed into law in July 2010, it was hailed as the boldest reform bill since the 1930s. It was designed to rein in the risky and reckless behavior by big banks that nearly brought down the economy. But in the last 3 years, lobbyists for the financial industry have been hard at work to water down regulations. This has infuriated our guest, Ted Kaufman, who completed Joe Biden's term as Delaware's U.S. Senator when Biden became vice president. Senator Kaufman fought for more accountability and transparency while in Congress in 2009 and in 2010. He later chaired the Congressional Oversight Committee of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. He's currently a visiting professor of practice at Duke University Law School. He writes for the Wilmington News Journal, for Forbes, and for Huffington Post. And Senator Kaufman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here, Marty.
So I do want to talk about all the bad news.
Sure.
And I have to say to our listeners, we were talking for a couple of minutes before going on the air, and I have to say I'm even madder now than I was yesterday writing up this program. But nonetheless, 3 years after Dodd-Frank, right. Have there been any improvements in the system from what you see?
I think the real question, Marty, is you go back. I'm an engineer by background. I went to Wharton. And my approach is let's go back and look at why we had this meltdown. Remember, it's 3 years since Dodd-Frank, but it's 5 years since the meltdown. And what were the causes of the meltdown? And with all the storm and drang and back and forth and all the things that happened, Dodd-Frank and the rest of it, if you identify the causes, what have we done to deal with the causes? And for an engineer, it's like building a rocket ship, finding out what went wrong, and then figuring out the 10 things went wrong. You don't put another rocket ship up until you fix it. So when you look at it, there isn't very much that we did to face the main cause. Some things we'd like credit rating agencies, we've done zero. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, we've done practically zero. Banks are still too big to fail. There's a consensus on that. I can give a long list of people that have done it. We really haven't done much yet on derivatives. The Volcker Amendment is still lying dormant.
And I think the separation of commercial and investment banks.
Well, yes, it's kind of trying to separate them without separating, without going back to Glass-Steagall. So when you look at the list of things, you just say we're in danger of doing this again.
And you think that? I mean, I don't want to overhype this, but you feel like we are poised to do
well,
what
I just
we
look,
did.
As I said, I look at it as an engineering approach. If you haven't dealt with the causes, if you agree what the causes are, and you haven't made any real progress, I think there were like 298 rules that were supposed to be passed, worked on by the regulatory commissions, and they passed just over 30%. So we're sitting here 3 years after Dodd-Frank, and 70%, close to 70% of the rules are not even in place. Clearly, that's not been dealt with.
Do you think, though, the country has been seduced by the fact that the stock market has done so well? It's like around 15,000, a huge recovery when it comes to the financial world.
Well, I think the public doesn't. I think a lot of people that are hurting still remember and are still upset about it. But I think what you have is the massive amount of money that Wall Street has put. And we put emphasis on lobbying. Clearly, the amount of money they spent on lobbying for the things they want, as opposed to the amount of money that's raised against it, it's just overwhelming. But when you look at the public relations campaigns they do and the way they deal with this thing and make it out to be complex, they keep talking about how they're overregulated and this much. And they build a good mindset in the American people that we don't want more regulation. And no one wants overregulating. One of the bad things that's happened after Dodd-Frank is we do have a lot of regulations, but they don't go to the causes of how we got where we are today.
It's interesting to look at Dodd-Frank, and it is being written slowly, even as we speak. Do you think that's part of the problem, is that this is almost 3 years, and it's still under review in a way?
Oh, absolutely. And I said this during the consideration. I gave a number of speeches on the floor and in committee. I talked about it a lot, and that is one of the big mistakes we made was we passed everything down to the regulators. Essentially, we said, we don't want to write the laws. Let's give it to the regulators. And regulators do a great job if, in fact, you define what they're supposed to be doing. The old thing about good fences make good neighbors. Mm-hmm. You could have put a good fence down, and then they can decide who's on one side or the other. This is what we did in 1933 after the stock market crash of 29. We set up a thing called the Procure Commission. They worked on what the causes were. They introduced a bill called Glass-Steagall. I think it had 35, 37 pages. It basically said that you have to decide you want to be in banking. You could be a commercial bank. You got FDIC insurance, Federal Deposit Insurance Company, insurance, and therefore you didn't have to worry about the runs. Runs on banks used to be a regular occurrence. And so what you did is you say the federal government stands behind them. Anybody that's watched Mary Poppins, there's the run on the bank in Mary Poppins. That's exactly what used to happen regularly. And then they said, if you want to be risky, that's good. It's good for the country. You have to be an investment bank. And so we split the two of them up, and it worked for over 60 years. And then in 1999, for a lot of reasons, we repealed Glass-Steagall, and I really think that was the basic problem. So if we'd passed a bill in Dodd-Frank like I wanted to, if we wanted to re-implement Glass-Steagall, go back, very conservative approach, that is, go back to what has worked in the past. And if we'd done that, then the regulators could have regulated. But now we can talk about it, but it's a nightmare out there with the regulators.
But do you think it's possible to roll back the clock and to separate this kind of banking, knowing how complicated banking is?
Oh, it's not. Look, Marty, that's one of the big things. They say how complex it is. I think it's a wonder, isn't it, that after the meltdown, we didn't fire a single CEO of a bank in New York, but we fired the CEO of General Motors. Now, let me tell you, as I said, I'm an engineer with an MBA. Banking compared to building and making and selling automobiles, I want to tell you what. General Motors is a million times more complicated than J.P. Morgan Chase. Now, J.P. Morgan Chase makes it complicated with derivatives and all these complex investments they're involved in. But why do we keep talking about how complex banking is? And General Motors was not complex. We couldn't fire it. The Brits, the U.K., Royal Bank of Scotland, they fired the CEO there, and it came out just fine. Hmm. So that's what that's where you have to look at. It's not that complex.
So if on your list, would you put then top of your list, reinstate Glass-Steagall?
Top of my list would be we have to do something about too big to fail.
Too big to fail. And
then Glass-Steagall could help with that. Glass-Steagall would help with that because it would reduce the size of the banks. But the biggest thing is while we were debating Dodd-Frank, and you can go back, I challenge anybody, go back and go to the Senate floor anytime. During that period we were negotiating on Dodd-Frank, every member of the Senate got up, Republican and Democrat, conservative and liberal, got up and said, we have to solve too big to fail.
Right.
That was the number one objective. That's what the American people wanted. We did not do that.
Why not?
Well, we didn't do it because we didn't put into place the things we needed to do to actually reduce the size of the banks. Are the banks too big? Well, let me put it this way. They were too big in 2008 for us to resolve. Remember? That's when we bailed them out. Since that time, we've added Wachovia, Countrywide, Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns to the big banks. The big banks are now bigger than ever. Tom Hoenig, who used to be with the Federal Reserve and is now the vice chairman of the FDIC, he did a study. The four largest banks in the world, when you consider it, all the factors, are our four banks.
Wow. Let me quote something you wrote in Forbes. This goes back to May, but you write, the headline is Fixing Too Big to Tolerate Banks.
Right.
You write here, my post here last week made the case persuasively, I hope, that banks are too big to fail, too big to prosecute, too big to regulate, and too big to manage, and definitely too big to tolerate.
Right. And that's Sandy Weill, who actually was the driving force at Citi behind the Glass-Steagall bill. He said we never should have done Glass-Steagall. Banks are too big to fail. You can get the former CEOs of Citi who say that it's too big to fail. You have Jeb Hensarling, the head of the Republican head of the Financial Services Committee in the House, says it's too big to fail. You got a whole string of Fed Fisher and Ben Bernanke who said it's too big to fail. You've got George Will saying the banks are too big to fail. There are very few people that don't work on Wall Street who say that the banks are not too big to fail. And there's a reason for that. The reason is we put in a thing called order to liquidation authority. And what we basically said is you have to wind these banks down. Well, you can't wind these banks down because these banks are so big and they have so many relationships. I think Citigroup has like 2,000 subsidiaries around the world. And there is no way, nothing in place now to resolve a bank across international borders. So you can have bankruptcy and resolve. I hear people say, well, we'll do it like a bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Bankruptcy in the United States, like an airplane, is easy. You do it in the United States. It's very difficult to do, but you don't have to resolve it across borders, and you don't have to do it while everybody is watching. So the Financial Stability Board, which is set up by the E20, says there is no resolution authority in place at this time. The finance minister for Germany wrote an article in Financial Times just last week saying that there is no resolution authority across borders. That's number one. Number two is these banks aren't going to fail just one. It's going to be just like 2008. they're all going to go down. It's one thing. What we did during 2008, we had J.P. Morgan Chase come in and buy Washington Mutual. Mm-hmm. They merged them. They bought Wachovia. We had Bank of America buy Countrywide. We had Bank of America take over Merrill Lynch. We had Wells Fargo take over Wachovia. There's nobody to take over Citi. There's nobody to take over J.P. Morgan Chase. You cannot resolve these things. You can't. It's not like Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch on one on Friday, it's independent. On Monday, it's part of Bank of America. That's a relatively easy problem. If you're going to take Citigroup and have them close on Friday, and we saw what happened in Cyprus, mm-hmm. where you know, the only way Cyprus was saved. How was it saved? I just ask our listeners.
I have no idea.
Well, it was saved because the government came in and said we will bail you out. Cyprus, we will send the money to do it. And you're going to see some leader in Washington faced with the fact that the banks are too big, they're going to fail, the whole financial system come down, just like the same thing that the Bush administration had to deal with. And right now, they have no way out.
Well, just to add another phrase to the too big to fail, Eric Holder famously right. or infamously said that these banks were too big to jail. Right. Is that part of the problem?
Yeah, part of the problem is one of the things that really works with white-collar people is deterrence. You know, maybe other people don't, but you tell a white-collar worker that maybe they're going to go to jail, and everybody at their club's going to hear about it, and everybody at their family's going to be embarrassed and the rest of it. Deterrence really works for white-collar crime, and we've known that for a long time, that we've not put in place any deterrence from what happened. Nobody went to jail. And I was one of the things I did when I was down there I was very proud of. I worked with Senator Leahy, the Democrat, who's the head of the Judiciary Committee, and Chuck Grassley, who's a Republican, and we passed a thing called the Fraud Enforcement Recovery Act. And basically it put $30 million into the Justice Department to prosecute people on Wall Street who were involved. Mm. We came out with a great big zero.
Is that because what was done was not illegal, or it's just that they stayed ahead of the regulators and the police, so to speak?
Well, part of it was they you're absolutely right. Good point, Marty. These are not like drug dealers. They clean up after themselves. But that's not the real reason why they got away. And one of the big reasons, as we turn out, is that the Justice Department said, well, you know, these are big financial institutions. We may not be able to try them. Lonnie Brewer, who is the head of the Criminal Division of Justice, now he testified before me twice. I met with him numerous times during this process. He testified on FIRA both after we passed it. He never once mentioned to me that there was any kind of concept that banks were too big to prosecute, mm-hmm. that we couldn't prosecute. This is a totally new approach that had never been used before. So we had that. That was the real deterrent. And Justice Department just didn't make this a priority. Basically, you had the fraud task force. They had two fraud task force. Neither one of them really went after the folks that were involved at the top of the banks. And I think that's it. Now, the banks do start out with a big head start. They do have a lot more money to defend it. But I think our prosecutors in the Justice Department do a good job. Marty, just think. Savings and loan crisis. We sent loads of people to jail on the savings and loan crisis. On this crisis, zero. Which one was a bigger problem, and which one has more of a problem to the country, and which more do we need more to turn? It was the meltdown.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Ted Kaufman, former U.S. Senator from Delaware. We are talking about the financial system, the financial industry, 5 years after Dodd-Frank, 3 years after Dodd-Frank, 5 years after the meltdown. We'll be right back.
The rate of new HIV infection in Philadelphia is 5 times the national average. There are more than 30,000 living with the virus in our city, and 1 in 5 don't know it. June is AIDS Education Month, and Philadelphia Fight is holding events throughout June for youth, faith leaders, medical providers, and the greater community, including National HIV Testing Day on June 27th. All events are open to the public. More about AIDS Education Month at fight.org/AEM. Philadelphia Fight supports WHYY.
You decide the winners at WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs, June 20th at WHYY in Philadelphia. Food fanatics will love this 2-hour tasting, featuring an array of mouth-watering munchies served up by local restaurants and businesses, all competing to be named 2013's Best of the Chefs, with summer beer garden, specialty cocktails, and live music. WHYY's second annual Best of the Chefs. Tickets at whyy.org/events.
Whether it's the Jackson 5 or Sister Sledge, musicians know that the family that plays together stays together. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. This week, Sound Opinions celebrates Father's Day with artists who've made rock a family affair. From husband-wife duos to sibling rivalries, it's the best family bands.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. 5 years ago, the country was on the precipice of a financial collapse. Almost 3 years ago, in the summer of 2010, the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act was passed, signed by President Obama. We're talking with Senator Ted Kaufman of Delaware about whether we have learned our lesson in the last 5 to 3 years. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. He spent 2 years as senator from Delaware, essentially replacing Joe Biden, who went on to be the vice president. And he's currently teaching at Duke University. And he writes for the News Journal, the Wilmington News Journal, for Forbes, and for Huffington Post. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I'm looking at an article by The Nation. And it says, outnumbered by bank lobbyists 20-1, the new Dodd-Frank finance reform law has been under siege by Wall Street lobbyists intent on weakening, delaying, and dismantling it. On one side, in 2012, the top five consumer protection groups defending Dodd-Frank sent 20 lobbyists to Capitol Hill. On the other side, the top five finance industry groups sent 406 lobbyists to Capitol Hill, a kind of David and Goliath situation.
Yeah, and it's even worse than that. Frankly, a lot of the people that were lobbying during Dodd-Frank, who I met with after it was over, they didn't have the money to continue. So the numbers in terms of money, maybe 20-1 in terms of lobbying firms, but it's even greater. And Kim Krowiak, who's a professor along with me at the Duke Law School, she did a study, and she went in and she looked at the Volcker Rule. Now, the Volcker Rule was that we couldn't get Glass-Steagall passed, which split up commercial banking from investment banking the way it had been for 60 years. The Volcker Rule was try to separate risky investing called proprietary trading. And so she checked on how many people lobbied the regulators. And there are four regulators had to decide what to do on the Volcker Rule. It's breathtaking. Yeah. She found out that of the people that contacted either the commissioners of the four regulatory agencies or the staff, 92% either were represented Wall Street banks, Wall Street lawyers, Wall Street accounting firms, or financial institutions. 8% was everybody else.
So does that, I mean, obviously that tells us about the power of the financial lobbyists, but does it also tell us about how we finance elections and how people get into office?
Yeah, no, but that's part of it. But this one, this is even even more deadly, because basically the regulators have to have a record on which to base their regulations. So the big mistake we made on Dodd-Frank was passing this down to the regulators, not passing something like Glass-Steagall, not like the PCORA Commission had done in 1933, and we gave it to the regulators. Now, the regulators have these roundtables. If you go to a roundtable, you're going to find that 8 out of 9, 9 out of 10 people there are from Wall Street firms, because there just aren't people on the other side. So when they come up with their decision, the regulator comes up with their decision, they have to justify it based on the people they've been contacted. And when the vast majority of people they've been contacted are from Wall Street, they have to take this into account. There's a famous case where the Circuit Court of Appeals, which has some very conservative judges on it, reversed the decision by the Securities Exchange Commission. Based on, they said, there wasn't enough economic analysis. So this is more than just the Congress, where you have an overwhelming people that have campaign contributions gone to certain members that are in favor of what we call the blob, the banking lobbying group, and a small percentage going for the other side. This is where the ultimate result has to be determined based on information that you receive, and the overwhelming amount of information they're getting is from the lobbyists.
This is quoting Matt Taibbi, who writes in the Rolling Stone about the financial industry, and he says how financial lobbyists succeed in getting what they want on the regulatory front, they never stop. Yeah. It's not a war of ideas, it's a war of resources. That's you march up the hill with some crazy idea about overturning a bill prohibiting bailouts of companies that engage in risky derivative trades. You get knocked down, and you march up again, and then you march up again and again and again and
That's
again.
Right. It's like a war in which one side has, you know, airplanes and ships and tanks and cannons, and the other side is there with, you know, small arms. and not a whole lot of ammunition behind the smalls. It's literally, that's the case of what it is. If you go down and look at, like I say, the Kim Krowiak study, 92% of the people that contacted the four regulatory agencies were representing Wall Street.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Sure. Looks like we have Dave from Maple Glen, Pennsylvania. Dave, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Marty, I'm glad to be on.
Thanks.
I think that, you know, we're downplaying the role of campaign money and also of the appointments of people to positions like, you know, Secretary of Treasury, who are complicit and part of the too-big-to-jail banks. And so the result is that the Justice Department doesn't prosecute these big banks because they gave all that money to the Obama mm-hmm. administration in particular, and the Bush administration before it. Enormous amounts of money. And then the personnel who get in these jobs, you know, like the Secretary of Treasury under Bush, Secretary of Treasury now, we're all connected to these big banks. And so we don't prosecute them.
Well, Dave, I have to say, Ted Kaufman is scribbling as you speak. Go ahead.
Dave, that you have made an absolutely excellent case. I wouldn't put it so much to the campaign financing, although that is a big factor, because the vast majority of campaign financing goes to the Republicans, not to the Democrats. And especially in this last election, Obama got just a fraction of the money from Wall Street that that Romney got. But what the point that you make is absolutely right, and that is the Obama administration. I was a big supporter of the Obama administration. The Obama administration decided the banks were too fragile and we shouldn't really do something about it. And one of the key reasons why the Dodd-Frank is the way it is because Secretary of Treasury Geithner decided that he did not want the Congress making these decisions, that this should be something to give it to the regulators, even though the regulators, Dave, as you know, I can tell you've thought about this, were the main cause of this. The lack of regulation was one of the big causes of this. So they decided, Geithner decided, that is not what he wanted to do. And so basically, when you're looking at Dodd-Frank, you had a combination of every Republican in the Senate, plus a big number of Democrats with the help of the administration deciding that they're not going to vote with it. And what's, you know, they made all the appointments from Wall Street. As you point out, Eric Holder and Lonnie Brewer from Justice Department, a Wall Street law firm. Mary Shapiro was from FINRA, which is the voluntary agency. You go right down the line. Gary Gensler, who seems to be doing a pretty good job, came from Goldman Sachs. The most disturbing thing, Dave, in terms of the administration is the Obama administration, even though they got little money from Wall Street, the two people they've appointed to the two major financial positions, one's Jack Lew, a great public servant, a really he was a former chief of staff to the president. He was worked at the State Department. He was the head of OMB, really a great guy. But when he left Citigroup, when he went to work for Citigroup in 2006, In his agreement was that he would not get certain benefits unless he went back to a responsible position in the federal government or regulatory agency. That is on the record. What an incredible conflict of interest.
That's that revolving door.
That's a revolving door. And the other one you have is the Securities Exchange Commission with Mary Jo White, who used to work for 10 years. Oh, yeah, she was a tough prosecutor, and everybody talks about a tough prosecutor. We need a tough prosecutor in 2008. 2009, that's when we had to do prosecute. The statute of limitations run out on prosecutions. We need a strong financial person and somebody not from Wall Street. For the last 10 years, she's worked defending people before the regulatory agencies, many times dealing with the same people that she mentored in the Justice Department in the New York District. And she's already on the decisions she's made so far. She picked just Wall Street people. Our new chief of staff is from Wall Street. The co-chairs of the enforcement division are from Wall Street law firms. Where are some good trial lawyers? Or how about some good people in the Justice Department, in the Justice Department and in the Securities Exchange Commission that have fought for years against these people that are now put in charge of these decisions? And the same thing with Jack Lew. He comes out. He's the only person He's one of the few people that's not from Wall Street, doesn't work on Wall Street, who thinks we haven't solved that we've solved too big to fail on Dodd-Frank. No one else in the Fed and the rest of it, I went through the list before, believes that is the situation. So you have a whole thing, constituency of people believing that Wall Street is so complex, we have to hire Wall Street lawyers, we have to start Wall Street accountants, we have to hire Wall Street CEOs, we have to hire people from Goldman Sachs, we have to hire people from Citigroup, we have to hire people from these big firms. And look, they're all friends. When you're sitting down to negotiate a settlement, and you're sitting across the table from someone that you worked with your whole career, and you have to work a deal out. Or if you're dealing with a big bank and you want to have a settlement, why is it than settlements with big banks. They never had to admit they did something wrong.
Dave, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But are you talking about a club or a cabal?
I'm not talking about either one. I'm talking about we are with our friends. We have a certain life. I think there are people that live on Wall Street. The people at Wall Street, you talk about a bubble in Washington, biggest bubble in the world. They think this whole thing's blown over. Right after it happened, they were saying, well, you know, it's time to move on. Jamie Dimon, the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, gave a speech in which he said in I think it was January of 2010, somewhere around there, we've suffered enough. It's time to move on. And where everywhere else I went in America, every place else I talked in America, they said, this is outrageous what the banks did. Aren't we going to do something about it? So it becomes, there's a state of mind on Wall Street. If you turn on any of the CNBC, which is, I've been on CNBC a number of times, or any of the Fox Business, the people that cover finance, you'll find one Wall Street person after another come up and complain about, oh, these burdensome regulations, we didn't do anything wrong, the people that did things wrong. They deal with this as if it was some kind of a hurricane, some kind of a natural disaster that hit us that we had nothing to do with. They don't want to talk about the causes. They don't know what it is. So when you're, everybody you talk to has that same view, you tend to have that kind of view.
And that's Ted Kaufman, former Delaware senator, and joining us today in Radio Times to talk about Dodd-Frank, almost 3 years after it was signed into law. Ted Kaufman fought for tougher regulations, for more transparency and accountability when he served in Congress in 2009 and 2010, filling out Joe Biden's term as senator from Delaware. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I have to say, one of the things that really concerns me is obviously we've got a Wall Street that is bigger and even it looks like more I'm not sure exactly what the word is, healthier or certainly more active than it was right 3 to 5 years ago. Then you've got the other part of the economy where you've got people still struggling to find a job, keep a job, get paid, get health insurance, figure out what to do about their house, their housing situation. It seems that we have this huge disconnect between the financial world and the rest of the country.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And that's the kind of problems you have when everybody you know is doing well and doing better. I mean, they did well. The stock market's back. I've done great financially. But they're not cheek to jowl with the millions of Americans that get up every day worried about their job, worried about their house. Sure, this economy's coming back. There's still millions of Americans that foreclosed houses. You look at what's going on with people who are working poor. Look at where the working poor are. They lost their jobs right away. How many people are still locked into jobs that they never liked and never wanted to do? So, no, I think that's really, Marty, what we're talking about. Do you have a view of the world that says, we got to make sure this never, ever, ever happens again? Mm-hmm. We got to do something about derivatives. Warren Buffett called financial weapons of mass destruction. We have to do something about derivatives so they don't bring it down again. We've got to do something about the separation between the risky investments and the commercial banking. We've got to put in Glass-Steagall to separate commercial banking from investment banking, get rid of the risky things. We have to do something about the rating agencies, the credit rating agencies. It's absolutely outrageous what they did. I mean, and so the credit rating, what have we done about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? The list of what we haven't done is just so long. And it's because I think people that are involved in it, they have friends, they live with people, they're surrounded by people who are just doing great, thank you. And they're not bad people. I don't think it's a cabal. I don't think it's a conspiracy. There's a thing in antitrust law. It's called conscious parallelism, where four different companies all set the same prices, but they don't meet and do it. One person sets a price and they follow what that price is. It's more of that. It's more like everybody I talk to, like I talk to some of my friends. They say, well, this is just, you know, I don't understand why you're doing this, Ted. I don't see why you're doing it. But let me tell you, Marty, for every one of those, there are 10 people that have come up to me in the last 5 years and said, I'm on Wall Street. I worked on Wall Street. Keep it up. You're right on. You're doing exactly what has to be done. The place is not the place it was when I started and when my father was there. It's not a place of ethics where people are concerned about the institutions. They're interested in one thing, and that is how can I make the most money, which is perfectly okay. But we got to have regulation in there to make sure that the interest of the mass amount of Americans is taken into account.
You worked for Joe Biden when he was senator for Delaware for more than 20 years. Right. You have his ear? Does he know?
Oh, no. But Joe Biden and I are good friends and the rest of it. He's got a lot of things he's doing. I've got things I'm doing. I don't lobby him.
And
you
can't pick up the phone and call him and say,
I don't lobby him and he doesn't lobby me. It's one of the deals we made.
Does he read you?
Oh, he listens to what I have to say. Yeah, he listens to what I have to say.
Let me see what Roger from Newark, Delaware has to say. And Roger, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Senator. We spoke about some of these issues 2.5 years ago on this very show, and I want to ask if you think the following, while not a cure-all, would be helpful here. Taking a page out of the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, where 80% of health insurance premiums have to be spent on providing health care. If you had a similar kind of percentage, whatever the number would be, of the money handled by banking systems with access to the Fed discount window, which had to be put out into the real economy rather than these exotic bets on bets or whatever you want to call them, do you feel that would be helpful?
Roger, thanks for the call. Go
yeah,
ahead.
You and I have talked about this before. I think that would be helpful, but I don't think there's any chance it's ever going to pass. I think most members of Congress don't believe you should, you know, put a cap on the way that you should make profits like we did in the healthcare business. But there's lots of things that we could be doing to deal with this. And I think that the one of the biggest things is the tax code. I mean, why do we not deal with the tax code? Mm-hmm. I mean, the tax rates are on – you have people, hedge fund managers, making literally billions who pay 15% taxes on what's called carried interest. It should be capital gains. It should be in ordinary income. It's counted as capital gains. As one senator pointed out to me, he was meeting with them. He said, you know, how can you do this? How can you take 15% when someone on minimum wage pays 15.5% interest? So there's loads of things that we can do. To deal with this, I don't think that a proposal to put of the type that you are offering has a chance of ever making it through the Congress. But the thought is there.
Roger, thanks for the call to Radio Times. About a minute before our second break here, but just picking up on the testimony of the Apple CEO before Congress. First of all, they were sort of shocked that he would use the tax system. It looks like to Apple's benefit. And then on the other hand, everyone said how much they love their Apple products.
That's right.
I mean, I'm curious what you make of that, what you made of that testimony, if that tells us something about.
Well, no, I think, look, when you look at the tax code, and again, it's the same way. This is not a conspiracy. Right. This is not a cabal or anything like this. This is essentially the fact that when you have masses of people coming to Washington, when you have the revolving door where people move in and out of the regulatory agencies, in and out of the Congress, they're worried about where their next job's going to come from, then you're going to have a situation where they're going to have the year. So when you write the tax code and you write business taxes, they know what's in there. They put the stuff in there for Apple. I mean, look at how much Romney paid on his income taxes. Okay, great. But why should they not be paying more? We're not asking to cripple the free enterprise system or anything like that. And in many cases, our tax rates are lower. When you look at our real corporate tax rate, it's probably lower than any of the other countries, even though on the surface. But when you get through, like Apple does, and like a number of other businesses do, where they use offshore banking, where they set up subsidiaries in Ireland or set up subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands or something like that, the effective tax rate they pay is extraordinarily low. And in fact, it can go to zero very, very quickly. So the whole tax code, if you want to see where special interests really thrive, if you want to see special interests, go to a hearing on the tax code and you will see lines and lines in the Capitol around the block of people lobbying to get some benefit of the tax code.
And that's Ted Kaufman, our guest today on Radio Times, former U.S. Senator from Delaware. And we're talking about Dodd-Frank post 3 years. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
With aortic stenosis, a few steps can leave you breathless. But for many older patients, open-heart surgery is too risky. Now, St. Mary offers a new way, the TAVR technique. Instead of opening the chest, a new valve is threaded through a small incision in the leg. Less trauma, less risk, and faster recovery than open-heart surgery. 215-710-5888. St. Mary Medical Center in Langhorne, supporting WHYY. It's your health. Expect more.
On the next Fresh Air, an untold story from World War II. Thousands of American soldiers deserted the front lines. Journalist Charles Glass says most served bravely in combat before leaving their units.
Those soldiers who fought continuously and were never rotated out of the front lines simply were under so much pressure for so long that they cracked.
Glass's book is The Deserters. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Managing the quality of our work and personal lives is, well, not easy. More often than not, we find ourselves overbooked in both areas to the point of not doing anything the way we really want to and running out of steam in the process. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, Work-Life Balance. What really is achievable? Today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Senator Ted Kaufman, Senator from Delaware, about whether the country is any better off after the 5 years of near implosion and also after the passage of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, which was signed by President Obama in July 2010. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You're in this unusual position in that you finished out Joe Biden's term. You didn't run for re-election, right. So you didn't have to go through the campaign process. Yeah. Do you think that frees you up to speak your mind?
Well, Marty, I think I'd do it anyway. I don't think that's kind of been who I am. And I also think that my position was politically incredibly popular. I mean, most Delawareans and most people around the country agree with what I'm saying. If you look I'm not just saying anecdotally, talking to people, just comments I've had, letters, everything else, people basically think the mass majority of Americans think you do about it. Now, my opponent, if I had run, would have had more money than you ever could do it. But look at Sherrod Brown.
Yeah.
Sherrod Brown ran Ohio incredibly outspent by the bankers, and he still won. So anyway, no, I think I would do it anyway. The problem with campaign finance, if you ask me, for the last 50 years, 40 years since I've been involved in this business, what's the single best thing we can do to reorient the priorities in Washington? It would be public financing campaigns. Now, that's extremely difficult now because of Supreme Court decisions, but that's still, I used to say even 20 years ago, I couldn't be president and do this. I couldn't be the Congress. I have to be the czar. If I were the czar of the United States, I would put in public financing campaigns. And the problem is people want to talk about the corruption. But essentially, it's like, Marty, if you and I woke up one morning and you basically said, look, I want to run for the Senate because I want to help the poor and disadvantaged. I want to make sure we get unemployment compensation out those who are hurting. I want to deal with the people that are having the housing foreclosing. And I woke up and legitimately said, I want to do something, make sure we don't have too much capital gains. I want to build growth. I want to cut the tax code for wealthy people. Who's going to get the money, Marty? And let's just say I believe that's not what I believe that's an important part of it. So the problem is the money is directed towards people who basically believe what the in this case, the bank lobbies and the people with money believe. And then when it comes up for re-election, but it's not a case where people are coming in saying, hey, here's $10,000. I want you to vote this. And just so we put this in perspective.
You're not allowed to do that.
Yeah, you're not allowed to do that. But there's a great quote from Webster, the great speaker, where he was getting lobbied. This was back before any of the lobbying laws, obviously. And he got a letter. He sent a letter to the radio industry, the railroad industry, which is big that time. He said, if you want to see another speech on the floor like the one I just gave, just send me $10,000.
Mm.
So back then, it's always been a problem. Our founding fathers knew it was a problem. If you look at Madison 10, they talk about how interest groups are going to be a problem. But we have to do something. Right now, it's just corrupting our society, and it's really distorting our priorities.
Well, I do want to get back to our callers, and we have a lot of them lined up to talk to you. But it is interesting, as you said, there's popular support for what we have been talking
exactly.
about. Nothing we have talked about is that heretical or even revolutionary.
Right.
Thinking other issues, you know, gun control. There are other issues as well that where there is overwhelming popular support, and yet there seems to be this inability to push things through Congress that people actually want.
Well, it gets very tricky about overwhelming support. If you look at the real polling data, and obviously Disraeli said there's three kinds of lies, damn lies, and statistics, and polling's a kind of statistics. But, you know, like on gun control, you know, basically when the NRA got through on the background checks and said it was going to set up a national registry of guns, which was not true. Again, people want to concentrate on campaign financing, and I think I've demonstrated, I think that's really important. It's this public relations, this ability to run ads in districts and get people going. But the American people are really, really split on most of these on most of these big issues. But this is not an issue on which the American people are split. Getting so that we never have again too big to fail banks, that is something that the vast majority of Americans agree on.
Let me see what Ann from Chester Springs has to say. Ann, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi there, Ann.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
You hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The FDIC is woefully underfunded to manage massive bank failures. I want to know what the possibilities Mr. Kaufman thinks are available to employ a bail-in like they did in Cyprus.
Thanks, Ann.
Yeah, no, I think any kind of bail, anything, is American people are opposed to. I think just the idea that the federal government's going to bail somebody out is just terrible. And the FDIC is underfunded, but guess what? Securities Exchange Commission is underfunded. The Commodity Future Trading Commission is underfunded. And basically, there's a group in the Congress, in the House of Representatives, that just does not want any regulation to take place, and they do not want our regulators. And the point is, you know, most Americans, there's been a great PR campaign to make Americans opposed to regulation. If you ask Americans in a poll, for regulation, they say no. But let me tell you what regulation is. Regulation is like a football game where you have referees on the field. And if you pull the referees off the field because they're holding everything up, what's going to happen in the pileups? And we basically pulled the regulators off the field in 2005, 6, 7, and 8, and look what happened. Mm-hmm. So we need regulation. We need FDIC. We need the Securities Exchange Commission. One of the reasons why we haven't passed these rules, like I say, only 30% of them haven't been dealt with yet, is because they are not properly funded, the SEC and the FDIC and the rest of them. So one of the things that's being done at the behest of the Wall Street is not funding the regulatory agencies. And you're absolutely right on point. It is no way that we can deal with these incredible problems and get them straight unless we have regulators that are properly financed.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times to see what Claudia from Philadelphia has to say. Claudia, go ahead. You're on the air. Hi, Claudia. Yes, no? No, we'll try to get Claudia
having me on.
Yeah, go ahead, Claudia.
Yeah, I think a lot of the problem is that the public just does not know what's out there. There are bills in both the House and the Senate to restore Glass-Steagall, and there is nothing in the media. There is no publicity. You don't even find it mentioned. I think if people knew that they could write their legislators and insist that this be done, that there is a way to stop the financial stranglehold of Wall Street and restore the finances of the country to the people through a real credit system, if they knew this, there could be a deluge of correspondence to their legislators.
Well, Claudia,
and also
you know, let me just stop you there, only because we've talked a lot about Glass-Steagall during this hour. We've done it in the past as well, but perhaps listeners don't know the sort of Glass-Steagall 101.
Right. Well, basically, after the great meltdown, the stock market crash, there was a PCORA commission. They settled on Glass-Steagall, and they were trying to deal with the fact of not just the 29 crash. They were trying to deal with the whole problem that banks were run on. If people got word that a bank was failing, they'd run out and do it. So they came up with the idea. They said, look, what we're going to do is have the federal government, up to a certain point, guarantee it. And they set up FDIC. And basically we said, if you want to be a commercial bank, you can get this FDIC insurance. We'll insure all the deposits up to a certain amount. I can't remember what it was. It was a relatively small amount, but it covered the vast majority of people. You can be a commercial bank. You're going to be a bank that's not going to make a big return, but you're not going to have a great risk. And for 60 years, we had banks. Every one of the banks that you know about, Claudia and Marty, they were all banks where they were commercial banks, and they could do it. Now, the rule was you couldn't get involved in risky investments. So they set up a separate, different kind of bank called an investment bank. Banks like Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, that their job, they said, look, we're interested in a higher return. Well, if you have a higher return, you're going to have a higher risk. But they were separated. And then in 1999, led by Sandy Weill, the former head of Citi, and the Clinton administration, Bob Rubin, Larry Summers, we repealed Glass-Steagall. So this was a bipartisan deal to repeal Glass-Steagall, and then all hell broke loose.
And that's really
is what it is. And today, when you look at the London Whale story with J.P. Morgan Chase, we lost $6 billion trading in it. Speculative trading. You look at the fact we made no progress on even the Volcker Amendment, Celia. The Volcker Amendment was like a we were going to limit the banks to proprietary trading. You couldn't use FDIC funds. But on the London Whale, the $6 billion, Jamie Dimon came out originally and said, who was the CEO, said, oh, this is not proprietary trading. And if you want to go look at the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations in the Senate, They had a hearing on the London Whale. You really ought to read it. It really makes the point that clearly it was speculative trading. So we have to stop that. And you're absolutely right. My basic belief, to the bottom of my being, is that ultimately we will reinstate Glass-Steagall.
Because that's we basic. Have to, in a way.
And the only question, Marty, is how much damage are we going to let happen to the American people before we reinstate Glass-Steagall?
Claudia, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And again, you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. We are jumping all over the place, but you had an interesting piece in Forbes also about Jamie Dimon, headline, Who Cares What Stockholders Think?
Right.
And again, I'm just pulling out a quote here. You say, corporate governance today has nothing to do with socialism or democracy. What is now clear is that many of our major corporations are operated as dictatorships by their managements, and stockholders have virtually no say in how they are run.
Marty, that's just the way it is. I mean, you have a case where 3/4 of the shareholders voted against a director, and the next day the director was put right back in place. You have shareholders not having rights. You have we had this say for pay, where basically the shareholders were asked what they thought about a CEO's pay, but not given the power to reverse it. When I was first got involved in this back when I was at Wharton, we used to talk about democracy. But there is no more democracy. It's totally run for the managers, and it should be run for the owners of the corporation.
Let me see what Stephen from Philadelphia has to say. Stephen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. First, I'd like to say I'm a huge fan of you and your former colleague, Jared Bernstein.
Yes.
I'd like to address a topic you raised earlier, which is the settlements wherein nobody, you neither admit nor deny wrongdoing.
Right.
And how that relates to a two-tier system of justice. I think you're familiar with the fact that Judge Rakoff's decision in the Citigroup case is now from the Second Circuit, and when he denied proving the settlement offered by the SEC, he noted that the injunction part of the agreement, in which they neither admit nor deny wrongdoing, has never been enforced. So that, in effect, there's actually two tiers of justice system. And if you look at the New York Stock Exchange specialist case, which is reported where criminal wrongdoing was proved, taking place by the brokers and specialists on the New York Stock Exchange in the late 90s, early 2000s, they only prosecuted the one- and two-man firms, where they barred them from further involvement in the securities industry. The larger firms like Spear Leeds Kellogg, which is the specialist branch of Goldman Sachs, they allowed to continue in operation, saying they were too systemically important to bar them from future activity. It would disrupt the markets.
Well, Stephen, let me take your call. You raise a really good point. Go ahead.
Stephen, you're absolutely totally on point. I think Judge Rakoff is a hero of mine. I think he's really spelled this thing out. The one small thing that I feel some of us have accomplished over the last 5 years is a small thing. The Justice Department in the HSBC case, where there's money laundering involved, Standard & Poor, they absolutely said they're not going to settle unless there is admission of wrongdoing. Mm. So they've broken with that for 20 years. Although Mary Jo White from the Securities Exchange Commission in testimony the other day said, no, we don't think we have to do that. How can you have a system of justice? If I rob a store, I don't get to make this part of my plea bargaining that I don't have to admit wrongdoing. Part of the problem we talked about, and Marty and I have talked about most of this show, is Wall Street really thinks they're right. Wall Street feels incredibly picked upon. I mean, they're a group of whiners about, oh, we're being dealt with all these terrible things. And they say, we never did anything wrong. They've paid, I guess it's over $1 billion in fines, and they still walk around and say they didn't do anything wrong. Mm. And the reason they do is because one of the reasons is they never had to admit wrongdoing. And this comes back to the revolving door. If you're an attorney that just left the SEC and you're dealing with people, colleagues that aren't at the SEC now, or you're at the SEC and you know you're leaving after this, and the revolving door at SEC is incredible. What are you going to do? You're going to say, oh, geez, Harry, you know, you and I, our family gets together, we're really close. I don't want to have you admit to your wrongdoing. We haven't done it for any other banks. Why should we do it for you? HSBC, it took money laundering and drug laundering before they actually would put in no admission wrongdoings. But, Stephen, you're absolutely, totally, completely right. this country cannot survive with two different tiers of justice.
Stephen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Did you consider in any way working as a lobbyist, or were there lobbying firms that were interested in
you? No. Obviously, no. I mean, I never thought about that. When I left Senator Biden's office in 95, I was doing a bunch of things. I was teaching at Duke and doing other things, and I thought maybe I'd lobby for some causes. But the only causes, there weren't any causes that was interested that I agreed with to lobby with. It's very, very difficult to find outfits that I would be living. I'm fortunate that I don't have to. I don't have the financial problems in order to deal with that. But no, I just think that you can't have two different types of justice. You can't have too big to jail, just like you can't have too big to fail. And in terms of too big to manage, when you look at $1 billion in fines, well over $1 billion worth of fines, you say, are they being well managed?
Hmm. We're almost out of time here, but what keeps you going?
Well, I think, you know, look, I have an obligation. That's like all of us. You know, we have an obligation to try to deal with what we think is right. And one of the things is, fortunately for me, I've had the opportunity to learn a lot about this. I try to explain it in ways that everybody can understand. I think it's really, really incredible and important to do it. And why do you get up in the morning? Some people, I always say to young people, there's a continuum with Mother Teresa at one end and Gordon Gekko at the other. And all of us are on there somewhere. And some people can just make money and go through life. And some of us have to be like Mother Teresa and not make any money. Most of us are in between. And once you find out where you are on that spectrum, happiness comes when you're living the life that you know you were made to live.
On that note, Ted Kaufman, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. A former U.S. Senator from Delaware, actually served on the Foreign Relations, the Armed Services, the Judiciary, and the Homeland Security Committees. After leaving the Senate, he was chair of the Congressional Oversight Committee of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. He's now a visiting professor of practice at Duke University Law School, and you can read some of his commentary in the Wilmington News Journal, in Forbes, and in Huffington Post. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can learn much more about this program. In fact, if you go to our Facebook page, you can check out what our guest looks like. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, but do stay with us. We'll be right back.